With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Unleashing the Beast. Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with me, Len Viterpik, standing in for Mark Morano. Just for today, he'll be back tomorrow. But the song remains the same. We'll still be talking about the same crucial issues that you expect, know, love and hate, and have an opinion on as well, I hope. If you do have an opinion, then as usual, do go to the tntradio.live site. You can join the chat, and you always get the best out of this show, and indeed my show at the weekends, by having that conversation. Oftentimes, the chat goes into directions and into depth that we simply don't have time to go into while we're on air. And you can find the phone numbers there too. If you want to phone in, you're most welcome to do so, to agree, disagree, suggest, promote, oppose, or simply praise how great you think the show is. That's acceptable too. I'll be here for the next couple of hours with two great guests, and I hope that you're going to enjoy the offering. As always, we have a theme. Today's theme is really centrally focused on American politics, not so much Middle Eastern politics or the politics of the UK, but the forthcoming general election, or as the Americans call it, the presidential election. And that is because this is a presidential election year. In November, the whole country goes to the polls and decides between the two front runners as they currently stand, Joe Biden for the Democrats and Donald Trump for the Republicans. Notwithstanding his legal issues, which we will discuss today, those seem to be the two people, even if there are other independents who come along at the last minute. To discuss that with me, in this hour, we've got Drew Thomas Allen, who is the author of America's Last Stand, Will You Vote to Save or Destroy America in 2024? Now, Drew is a very interesting character, brutally honest in Drew's account of the historic failures of the Biden administration. And more than that, Drew masterfully lays out the real and severe stakes of the 2024 presidential election, really indicating that this is a watershed, a fork in the road for the United States. And to some extent, that means the Western world. We'll be speaking to Drew shortly. And after Drew, we speak to Donna Jackson. Now, Donna Jackson is the Director of Membership Development for the Project 21 Black Leadership Network, a seasoned accountant with public and private sector experience. So may have something to say about Donald Trump's accounting issues, we might say. Let's not get sued tonight, but maybe something interesting to hear there. And prior to her career in accounting, she was a political operative in the state of Arkansas and in Little Rock. Now, that interests me because Little Rock is where a former president of the United States, the Democrat Bill Clinton, and of course his wife Hillary Clinton, who's been pretty senior in politics in the US as well, cut their teeth. So I'm sure Donna can give us inside insights, and you never know, we might get a scoop or two as well today. All of that here on the next 2 hours or so with me. As I say, wherever you are watching in the world, I'd love to hear your views. Go to tntradio.live. The regular viewers know that I will comment on your comments as best I can. Time is always short, so apologies if I don't read out your message. It's not personal. I am not disrespecting you. I just have to get through as much as I possibly can in the remaining 110 minutes. So we've got those two great guests coming up. But before I introduce the first guest, let me share something which I've been observing today in the UK mainstream media. I took my child to school, as I often do, and then I put the radio on to the state-sponsored radio channel. In the 20 minutes I was listening at peak time in the morning during the rush hour, when if you're likely to be listening to the news on that particular station, that's the time you're likely to be listening. And to my amazement, there were three stories. The first one was about musicians who can give 50% of their royalties to nature. And we had Brian Eno, a musician whose musical skills I greatly respect and was instrumental in creating many new sounds, talking about the benefits of giving your royalties away to nature, as nature being an achiever, a contributor. I'll read you the actual headline if I can find it. And yeah, nature officially becomes a musician, earning royalties for environmental causes. This is, of course, a state-sponsored channel. It goes on to say, when Paul McCartney was putting the finishing touches to Blackbird in 1968, he called up the EMI Sound Effects Library and requested a tape labeled Volume 7, Birds of Feather. Well, on it goes, and the argument is that nature deserves its cut of royalties. Well, okay, interesting. I'll come back to that in a minute. The next story was about the need to have more trees in urban areas. I think the organization was called Trees for Cities, and the lady speaking about that in a very sincere way was saying how important it was to plant trees and how there weren't enough trees in urban areas. A worthy cause. Great interest if you happen to love trees. And she had some specific targets as well involving the mnemonic 3300, just about the number of trees, how far you should be away from the tree, how many trees you should be able to see. And then the third story was about a child who'd found a dinosaur bone, and she was back to talk about the excitement she felt when she found it. Now, all three of those stories sound perfectly benign. They're quite interesting, actually. But let me ask you this question. Is giving money to nature by obviously rich musicians, planting more trees in cities, and dinosaur bones found by kids really the most important stuff that's going on in the world? Is it possible that in some way we're being told what to think is important and not to worry about the rest? In my view, if the taxpayer is sponsoring the news, the taxpayer has a right to expect a little bit more discernment about the most important issues facing the world right now. Don't get me wrong. I don't think there's any problem in having a variety of stuff on the television or the radio. In fact, I think that provides a lot of what you might say relief and texture to a show. My concern is that we had a triple whammy of trees, giving money to nature, and dinosaurs, when we are on the brink of a potentially rather disastrous military situation in more than one place in the world. What's going on? Now, many who contribute to the chat whenever I'm on today's News Talk TNT suggest that there is something of a conspiracy, a degree of collusion, that we're being told what to think and what to value. It's hard to disagree with that when these are the subjects that we are being fed whenever we're listening to mainstream media that purports to be telling us what we should be concerned about. Now, there are other ironies. For example, the Scottish Parliament has just essentially abandoned its environmental agenda by saying it's not going to aim for the targets it originally set itself for 2030. Now, that has had some coverage. I didn't hear much about it this morning. But when you're listening to something which sets up the day, sets up perhaps what you think about and what you might research yourself in your own time on the internet, I really expect a little bit more. A couple of thoughts about this. Every time one makes a show, one curates. As soon as you decide what to put in, de facto, you are deciding what not to put in. Even this show, with our best intentions, is curated because we only have a limited time on what we can cover. In the course of a year, hopefully, we cover everything that matters. But when it comes to deciding what we cover in any one day, we are agile enough here at today's News Talk TNT to alter the agenda to reflect what's going on. I personally doubt the competence of those stations that go so left field, it begins to read or sound or look like a magazine you might read as you're waiting to go into a doctor's appointment or something that you might pick up for a trip on a train. But that is what we are being fed. And I have to say, I didn't think I'd say this, perhaps those who believe that there's a greater conspiracy are right. Perhaps we're being told not to worry our pretty little heads about the big stuff. Instead, talk about dinosaur bones, tree hugging, and, giving money to nature. And on that third one, there is once again a subliminal message, which brings me to my second point. The assumption is that planting lots of trees is a good thing and not having lots of trees near you is a bad one. Now, if you deconstruct that, we observe two things. One is somebody who's running a campaign like that, however well-intentioned, may be missing the point when it comes to somebody who's on the 30th floor of a multi-story apartment block, who hasn't got a parking space or indeed a car, who goes to work on the subway or the underground, and they could only dream of the luxury of spending time looking at trees. It's a middle-class pursuit being perpetrated, perhaps that's too strong a word even, promoted, let's give it the benefit of the doubt, by individuals who genuinely believe that planting trees is going to make a material difference to somebody who's working 7 days a week to just about manage. And so we see a hint of a collusion between a certain class, an empowered and comparatively wealthy class, and the editors of this particular program, and I'd suggest the station. The other thing we learn is how nudging politics works, the idea that you're pushed gently, almost imperceptibly, in the direction of something that they might want us to believe or be focused on. And that's the tree. That's also the tree story. The idea that maybe because we've wrecked the climate, we have to plant all these trees is a fairly obvious connection. But the music story is the same, because when it says, and I quote now from Brian Eno, it's a way of saying to artists, we all use sounds like seagulls and waves and wind. Why don't we pay nature a royalty? Hopefully it'll be a river or a torrent or a flood of royalties. And then what we do is distribute that among groups of people who are working on projects to help us deal with the future. What Brian Eno's talking about is the Green Movement, a movement which has just essentially been abandoned by the Scottish government, a Green Movement which was recently abandoned in large part by the British government. A Green Movement which seems incapable of giving us a scientifically coherent explanation in regard to why climate change can create droughts, heat waves, floods, and big chills. So what Brian Eno is really telling us is that we should give royalties to a Green Movement which is in fact a religious cult. Religious in the sense that it's more an act of faith than an act of science. And a cult, because if you don't agree with a cult, you get signed out, you get cancelled, and you get oppressed. Not one question was asked in the interview about giving royalties to nature, which suggested perhaps you are so rich that you can afford to give half of your returns to trees and plants and the Green Movement. But obviously, if you're just about managing, if you're on the 32nd floor of a tower block, you're unlikely to have the luxury of saying, I'm going to give half of my income away. So let's take a step back from this and see what we learn. We learn that while it's good to collect dinosaur bones on beaches, most people haven't got the time to do it at the moment. We also learn that while it might be nice to see trees out your window, most people who are suffering don't have the time to do that at the moment. And we learn that while it's nice to be altruistic and a philanthropist, most people haven't got the money to give cash to the Green Movement, which tells us we're wrecking the climate, which is nonsense, and insists that we change our ways and go back to some semi-agrarian society where we don't use too much fertilizer, we don't eat too much meat, and we probably plow the land by hand. All of that makes me believe that as we progress in this decade, we see an unhealthy alliance of the middle class telling the working class what they should care about. Can this be sustained? I end on a positive note in my little monologue. I don't think so. Once you push people too far when it comes to their standard of living, they'll push back. There's a general election in the United Kingdom this year. The public have the right to vote. The only problem is, of course, that the Uni Party, also known as the Conservatives and Labour, have nothing to separate them on these issues. And in America, it's different. We have Joe Biden on one side and Donald Trump on the other. Is it a Uni Party offering or something better? Is there a chance to change the direction of the United States and then potentially the direction of the First World? I'm glad to tell you that's the question we're going to tackle in the next 100 minutes on the Mark Morano Show. And we'll be starting in great style with Drew Thomas Allen to answer the question, is it America's last stand? And will you vote to save or destroy America in 2024? All of that with me, Len Bitopek, standing in for Mark Morano, right here on Unleashed on today's News Talk TNT.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
If you go back 3 years ago and ask people why they're wearing a face mask, they'll soon give you an answer. But if you go back 4 years ago and ask the same person why they're not wearing a face mask, the two answers would be so extremely distant from each other that it'll boggle your mind. The only thing that changed was that someone on a television told them they might die if they didn't. Part of the reason we're in such dire straits today is the inability for some people to question the basic principles of what they've been told.
Talk that matters. Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk TNT. TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
Welcome back to the Mark Morano Show Unleashed with me, Len Bitopek. Just standing in for today. He's back tomorrow. And I'm delighted to introduce our first guest for the evening or morning, depending where you happen to be. And that's the incomparable Drew Thomas Allen. Three first names. As I said to him a minute ago, I haven't got any. He's got a tremendous pedigree. One of America's rising conservative stars, also regarded as a brutally honest spokesperson. And in his book, America's Last Stand, it's said that he lays out the real differential between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Rather than hearing it from me, though, let me introduce Drew himself. Drew, welcome to today's News Talk and Unleashed. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's so great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about your views. You do get a very good write-up, and you sound like a little bit of a hard hitter. There's a certain species of dog in the UK called a Rottweiler, which is very friendly until it gets angry, and then it goes for the throat. Is that you, Drew?
Yeah, that's me. I mean, I think that's the spirit of certainly the American people, or ought to be. If you go back in our history, come and take it. And of course, the infamous snake. Look, I've grown up conservative, but in liberal circles. I always tell people I went to, a very esteemed all-male college preparatory school in Dallas, Texas. I worked in Hollywood. I worked in fashion. I speak Italian. I lived and worked for Marc Jacobs in fashion for 2.5 years in Italy. And then I did that in LA some as well. And then I got involved in politics. I'm a publicist for many famous people, Tulsi Gabbard, Alan Dershowitz. These are people that I've done publicity for or continue to do publicity for, Carrie Lake. I mean, on and on and on. I mean, so, I do have some understanding of the inner workings and behind the scenes of politics. And I think that is an important thing that the American people get a taste of and get to understand, because, it's like the movie from 1939, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. The corruption that is present in D.C. and in governments across the world, it's very real. And if you go in and you're not a Rottweiler, if you go in because you're domesticated and soft and a nice guy, they're going to chew you up and spit you out like bubble gum. And that's kind of what's going on right now.
Though some people prefer bubblegum to scary dogs. Maybe that's the problem in the UK at the moment and in the European Union. The question that what you have described prompts me to ask before we get into the policy is this. Do you regard yourself as a mercenary hired gun who'll work for the highest bidder? Or are you an ideologue who's looking to work with those who share your narrative?
Well, certainly I am an ideologue, more or less. You know, I mean, I don't come in here and just do it. I mean, part of that, I got to be honest, too, it's even if I wanted to be, and I'm not, I am a principled person, but even if I wanted to just go to the highest bidder, in this day and age, the way things are so polarized, nobody on the left would touch me. You know, with the exception of having like an Alan Dershowitz and doing his books and things like that, it's not going to happen. The left views you as radioactive material if you deal with anybody or have a view that is not in alignment with them. You know, if I believe there are two genders only based on science, well, you know, that's not appropriate anymore. I've got to deny science to be a Democrat.
I'm suspecting that the Democrats couldn't tempt you to cross the floor, not least because of the title of your book, America's Last Stand, Will You Vote to Save or Destroy America in 2024? It clearly dates the book. It'll become, hopefully, a tome of predictive genius after November. What caused you to write this book? Is it to warn people, to persuade people, or just to make predictions, or to make a lot of money, maybe?
Well, I did it to persuade people. I mean, there's not too much money in the literary world unless you're very, very famous and so on and so forth. No, I wrote the book because I have a one-year-old daughter. I, of course, am a patriotic American citizen, and I see what's happening to this country. And what is happening is unprecedented in our history. And it is a critical turning point in American history. 2024, it is not hyperbole to say, it is not just the most important election in our lifetime. It's certainly one of the most important in our history. And it is on par with 1776 and 1861, the American Revolution, the Civil War. Now, we're trying to resolve all of this and take back our destiny peacefully with elections. And what's so shocking is the Democrat Party and establishment, the deep state, there are many names for it. It's the Uniparty. It's the government that is looking out for itself and not the American citizen, certainly. The tyrannical ideologues that gravitate towards any government, frankly. Well, I mean, they're looking to, of course, transform this nation in particular to undo the Constitution, which says that we the people are master and those in government are servant. That's what's remarkable about America's Constitution, of course. Our rights are unalienable. They come from our Creator, not from our government, not from man. And yet these people believe that. And so, you know, while we are trying to use elections, they're trying to take elections away from us. They're interfering in elections. You can go back to 2020 and talk about the mail-in ballot situation, but we don't have a system. We don't have people in this country that are unified in terms of their respect and reverence for the Constitution, the rule of law. And I've said too, by the way, if I felt confident, if I could be secure, if we had one day of voting and there were no mail-in ballots and I could trust that every legal vote was being counted and there were no shenanigans going on, that everyone was interested in the security of these elections and that only American citizens vote, if I believed in that, I could almost stomach that, hey, I lost. I didn't do enough. We didn't do enough to convince the American people that this country was worth saving. But unfortunately, we're in a situation where you can't say that.
And the reason you say that is because at the risk of indicting both of us the way that Trump's being treated at the moment, and we'll talk about Trump and Biden specifically in a short while, Drew, but at the risk of indicting you, you're suggesting that maybe not everything was rosy in the flower bed of the election in 2020.
No. I mean, look, it's there's so many ways you can go with this. I'm not saying that space aliens hacked into the computer systems with, you know, lasers. That's not what I'm talking about. And you don't need to. It's mail-in ballots. I mean, you see the evidence everywhere. Firstly, you can just use your own mental capacity. I mean, look, if they tell us, of course, that Joe Biden is the most popular president in American history, which is true if he got 81 million votes. So, you know, when I hear stories about Obama is giving him advice for his second campaign, I don't understand why Obama would give him advice when he, Joe Biden, is far more popular than Barack Obama ever was in the country. And if Donald Trump was so easy to beat in 2020, as they tell us, if he's so unpopular, why go through all these efforts to try and interfere? Why not just leave it up to the American people? Why try to force him even off the ballot? They should be desperate for Donald Trump to, of course, be the nominee. He is, because he was so easy to beat in 2020. And of course, none of this adds up. And, you know, we don't have time to probably get into it today, but we could get into J6 and what that was really about. Obviously, intellectually, they want to tell us it was an insurrection. Trump was trying to overturn the election results. Well, actually, if you look at the results, it was very harmful for Donald Trump because we had a legal opportunity to finally contest the election. It's in the Electoral Count Act in this country, or was until they revised it to some extent. So, you know, J6 obviously benefited who? Joe Biden and the deep state, because they prevented us discussing any kind of voter fraud, and they rubber stamped all these Republicans that were prepared to contest the election results. Well, they bent the knee under the pressure of the insurrection. So, I mean, it's very clear to anybody who's open-minded and has a couple of brain cells that they're still willing to rub together to understand what happened in 2020.
So, yeah, the you're talking, of course, about J6 for our British audience. The attempt at, well, the actual break into Capitol Hill, in which Donald Trump became embroiled in a legal sense. From what you're saying, as I say, we can talk about policy and the relative merits of Trump and Biden in the next part of the show. But just at this point, this is fascinating to me. What is your perception of Trump's involvement in that then? Because you're implying that it was counterproductive for Trump. That occurred as it did.
Yeah, absolutely counterproductive. His role in that was nothing. You know, the evidence is there. What we do know, as a matter of fact, is that many Democrats, powerful Democrats, many powerful players behind the scenes, Republicans too, but certainly Nancy Pelosi, who at the time was Speaker of the House, all of them appeared to want something like an insurrection to take place, or at least the appearance of an insurrection to take place on January 6th. They lied about Donald Trump not offering the National Guard. We know that they intentionally created a circumstance where there wasn't a big enough police presence there. They certainly agitated the crowd. There's people in the audience that we know were feds. We know the FBI was present. Why were there so many embedded there that day? But at the end of the day, you know, what was supposed to happen on January 6th, and this is all people really need to know, you know, when the Democrats say, for example, that there was no evidence of fraud, that it was, you know, that the courts, you know, said there was no evidence, that's not true. However many times they quote, 50, 51 times, whatever it was, you had judges that actually refused to hear the cases. And so you actually had cowards that wouldn't touch the issue. So none of these courts even heard evidence. So on January 6th, that was really kind of the nuclear option, if you will, in many ways, because the Democrats have tried to do this countless times when they've lost elections in the past. Based on the Electoral Count Act of 1887, if you have a member of the House of Representatives and a member of the Senate who both agree to contest a state election result, you can actually go forth and have debate and potentially even send that back to the states, of course. So it's just, it's a legal measure that hadn't been tried before. And so obviously that was prohibited from taking place. We finally had a chance to hear all this evidence. We finally had a chance to contest the election as Democrats had tried to do before and failed. And you have all of a sudden this convenient insurrection narrative. And by the way, working in the media, when you have, you know, every single news outlet simultaneously in real time framing this as this is an insurrection, you know that things are coordinated. By the way, if anybody's ever worked in the media, you understand how these talking points work and circulate. And you have to be totally ignorant to think that this was some kind of organic happening.
Well, okay. Now, you see, there's an ironic thing here because on the one side, you could say that if Trump is innocent, that the invasion of Capitol Hill was organic. On the other side, you could say that was also the case with the voting, the ballot, the postal ballot. I'll share my opinion, but I'm interested to know yours. I can see the point you're making about the insurrection or the invasion of Capitol Hill, where it seems to me Trump's words have been taken slightly out of context, and you'd have to be really rather gullible to assume that nothing would have happened if Trump had said nothing. But on the other side, I have come across electoral fraud around postal ballots in the United Kingdom. I've been involved in politics for 35 years here. So I'm perfectly willing to believe that having a mass-scale postal ballot alters the dial. Why would you say on that latter point that it would necessarily alter the dial in Biden's favor and in the Democrat favor? Is that something which is fairly statistically secure as a statement?
Well, in terms of my perception of what J6 was about, yeah. I mean, yeah. Look, we believe and we know based on the history of mail-in ballots that there's enormous opportunity for fraud. Most countries that are saying have banned them, and including France even. And yet, and we've actually said that ourselves. And yet, obviously, we had unprecedented use of mail-in ballots in 2020 under the guise of COVID and so on and so forth. So we know there was fraud. And so you get to January 6th. With the certification process, and what Donald Trump had been pushing to do was to explore that process, to actually have those contested election results in different states debated in front of the American people on TV in the chamber. And so for him to try and incite an insurrection, which was to accomplish what? I mean, it wasn't an insurrection is the first point. Nobody had weapons. The only person who died of unnatural causes, despite the media's lies, was an unarmed military veteran named Ashley Babbitt. Obviously, it wasn't pretty when you watch the cameras, but it certainly was actually less violent than the summer of protests done by Black Lives Matter and so on and so forth in America. So the point is, you had enough representatives who were willing to debate this and push this to the limit. There were discussions about what Mike Pence's role could have been, and it was very cloudy. It was something that constitutionally hadn't been tested. The Electoral Count Act of 1887, here's the irony. That was actually created 10 years or so after Democrats actually did steal an election. Okay, so 1876, you actually had the Democrats steal an election. It was the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes versus the Democrat Samuel Tilden. And Democrats stole it. Samuel Tilden won. And Republicans back then didn't fold like cheap lawn chairs. They said, screw you. We know you cheated and we're not backing down. But there was no process to deal with it. It was unprecedented. So they worked out a deal behind closed doors, made some concessions to Democrats, but ultimately Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican who lost, became the president. And so 10 years later, they created the Electoral Count Act of 1887 to say, hey, if we have a stolen election again, how do we deal with this? And it was a very shoddily put together act that said that, okay, you can on the certification day, if you have a member of the House and one member and one senator contest, you can debate this in the House and so on and so forth and actually, you know, reverse this. So anyway, all that was legal. And so what happened on January 6th took that off the table. You had all these people who were willing to actually put this to the limit, to talk about fraud. And then you have this apparent insurrection, which, of course, was people inside mostly taking selfies. And we know that the Capitol Police were letting them inside, were guiding them around, were taking them into the chamber, these places that you couldn't even reach if you were just an average American citizen, because by design, the Capitol building is not straightforward. And so, obviously, this didn't benefit Trump. It rubber stamped Joe Biden's certification. And also it labeled anybody who questioned election results. It served to silence them. So we can't talk about what happened in 2020. It's like the ultimate cover up of the crime of the century, basically, is what J6 was.
We'll go to a break. But before we do, and after the break, I really want to talk about Biden and Trump, everything from immigration just to the very stark distinction that you're saying in your book is presented to America this time around. But before we go, how many votes actually did the American presidential election rest on in 2020? So let me put it this way. How many thousands of people would have had to vote a different way in order for Trump to have won?
Well, it actually came down to less than 60,000 votes. Less than 60,000. Because you're talking about swing states. So it was actually a very, very small number.
And so it's hardly surprising that Donald Trump was saying, when you've got so many millions, tens of millions upon tens of millions of votes, that it was really too close to call. In your judgment, then, just so that we finish on the process before we talk about the policies, in your judgment, what should have happened when Donald Trump challenged the outcome?
Well, the Democrats, if they were so confident that the election was fair and square, they should have also taken the position that, hey, we want to do everything in our power to ensure a peaceful transfer of power. And so if the American people need confidence in this process, let's let it play out. We have the legal mechanism in place to do it, and we have nothing to fear because we didn't steal the election and these claims are baseless. But instead of acting like innocent people that wanted to explore this process, of course, they acted guilty and tried to shut down the process.
Well, they succeeded as well, actually. After the break, I want to talk to you about really the core of what your book seems to be about, the difference between Biden and Trump. And I think this will probably be a pretty fascinating insight that you can give us. You're listening to me, Lemmy Dobick, standing in for Mark Marana here on Unleashed on TNT Today's News Talk. As we talk about the American presidential election past and future, and perhaps as the finale with Drew Thomas Allen, we're going to be discussing his take on the difference, his take on the dilemma facing the American electorate. All of that with me, Lemmy Topic, standing in for Mark Marana here on Unleashed on today's News Talk TNT. See you in a minute.
From weather and traffic reports
to news of political developments,
we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked in the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre, surtout que je m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with a free press.
Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced.
Press freedom is your freedom.
Around here, bushfire is just a part of life. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. The people here all look out for each other. We're a community that does its bit to plan and prepare, to keep everyone safe. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
Fearless, informative, and unfettered. Mark Marano is Unleashed on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Mark Marano Show, Unleashed with me, Lemmy Topic. I'm just standing in for him today. He'll be back tomorrow. Lots of commentary. Let me just first start with your views about what I said in regard to the musicians who seem rich enough to give half of their royalties away to nature. To nature. In other words, environmental groups that tell us there's a climate emergency. Holly says, good evening, Holly, by the way. Bono on stage. Every time I clap my hands, a child in Africa dies. Audience member, well, stop clapping your hands then. Okay, thanks for that, Holly. Lord Melbury, says, contrast Bono with Roger Waters. I know who I'd rather spend a night in the pub with. Thanks for that. And then let's talk about what you've been hearing from Drew, my guest at the moment. Drew knows his stuff. says Craig Abath. A good guess, Lambert. The Democrats wanted to move on as quickly as possible. Guilty of cheating, methinks. Thanks for that, Craig Abath. Beefat Chuck says, I literally watched them change the numbers when it became obvious that Trump was going to win. Craig Abath adds, at 10 p.m. on election night, Trump was ahead and it was in the bag for him. But they shut down all the voting stations and got stuffing the drop boxes, and suddenly Trump wasn't winning anymore. And one more, Hemingway, who's always good value, Drew, says, a top U.S. pollster who believed that Trump was done for has now suggested that he isn't. Our company predicted that he couldn't come back from an impeachment or from January 6th or from any of these court cases, but he has. When the ex-president was alerted to the new poll results, he crowed, I'm a survivor. I know how to survive. Probably the best survivor ever. Drew, is Trump a survivor? And will he survive all of the impeachments, all of the felony charges, and all of the negative publicity and get back to the White House?
Yeah, in one sense, Trump's a survivor, but he's not. He's more than a survivor. He's a winner, and he's a fighter. I mean, he's not. There's nothing. There's no victimhood in Donald Trump. I mean, look. We are witnessing somebody who is absolutely spectacular, just a unique human being. And if I always encourage people to try and put yourself in Trump's shoes mentally just for a second. I mean, this is a guy who has been persecuted since he came down the golden escalator at Trump Tower. Somebody who has faced unprecedented persecution by an opposing political party and the U.S. government at large in our history. He's the most persecuted politician in American history, and he's still standing. I mean, this is somebody, nobody else would be able to survive any of this. He still goes out there. He gives speeches. I mean, think about your own life, how you would crumble if you had to go and spend time in a courtroom and you knew, like, the New York situation where you're probably not going to even get a fair trial. You've got people who have come out, rejected from the jury pool, acknowledging as much, and yet he still goes forward. He still fights for the American people. You know, nobody's perfect. And I always tell people, you know, Trump deserves absolute respect for what he's endured for the American people and, frankly, people around the world.
That's a strong endorsement. And indeed, it's fair to say, I think, that your book really makes what certainly Trump supporters would regard as an irrefutable case to re-elect Trump. And you associate the re-election of Donald Trump with the abandonment of authoritarianism. Why is that?
Well, that is what Trump represents today. What we face in 2024 in America is a very clear decision. And this should be the easiest election of our lifetimes, actually. We are back in 1776. It is a second American Revolution. And what I mean by that is largely ideological, but obviously it has grave consequences depending on which decision you make. Now, what were the American revolutionaries, the early colonists, the early Americans deciding? Well, they were making a decision about whether or not the American citizen himself or herself had control over their destiny. And so they rebuked King George III, obviously, and they set about creating a new nation that claimed in its founding documents, the Constitution, for example, and even the Declaration of Independence. People can't forget about that. It wasn't a one-time off, screw you, King George. These are the grievances that you should be reading with the Constitution. It's very important to this country. It's a very dangerous document, too, if you ask the Biden administration. They've slapped a warning label on our founding documents, of course, in the archives. But nonetheless, the founding fathers said—
Hold that thought. Yeah. What do you mean? I didn't know this. Are you being literal?
Yeah. I think I wrote about it in my book, too. Yeah, no, I'm serious. Yeah, they actually slapped a warning label, the National Archives did, on our founding documents, saying that they are dangerous. Yeah. I'm dangerous, too.
That just sounds unreal. That just sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
To essentially warn people against the Constitution, essentially.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one of the remarkable things when I went through the book, you know, because I do chronicle the historic failures of the Biden administration. And it's just one after another. And it's like, You know, I've written articles about this where I call it the arson strategy of the Democrat Party, which is they're constantly lighting new fires, setting things ablaze. And so you can never get your bearings as an American. You're always distracted. You know, you're just like today, you know, every day they're breaking through the glass ceiling of insanity they set for themselves the day prior. And you think it can't get worse or crazier. And of course it does.
You almost make it sound like a kind of farce that that one of my favorite comedians, Larry David, would create. He's advising Joe Biden or even being the president himself. But just I did interrupt you, and you were making a really important point, Drew. But just to bank this point, that the Biden administration, and not an administration before him, but the Biden administration, have warned people that the core documents that define the operating system of the United States of America, the principles and values, is a dangerous document.
100%. Everyone can look that up. That is 100% true. And it happened actually earlier in his presidency. It was years ago. And you know, you see that's true. Obviously, you know, they view Christians as a threat. They call, you know, Christian nationalism. I mean, everything that actually is a bulwark against tyranny in America is, of course, dangerous. But it's not dangerous to Americans. It's dangerous to tyrants. And so the documents, obviously, I mean, the Declaration of Independence says very clearly, basically, if your government becomes tyrannical, you have the right to replace it with another one. That scares the crap out of them. Our Second Amendment, which is not to hunt deer that might be wearing Kevlar vests, as Joe Biden likes to say. That's not why we have a Second Amendment right. The Second Amendment is about preventing a government from reducing a citizenry to slaves again. And so, you know, they attack that amendment. They attack free speech because, of course, you know, God forbid we get to have a conversation right now about our own grievances with tyrants around the world. You can't have that out there ruminating, infecting people's minds with ideas of freedom and your rights being unalienable. No. Your rights come from Joe Biden, of course.
So, all right. So that's sorry to stop you, but that's a bit of a bombshell for me. And I will look that up afterwards, not because I don't trust you. I just want to see that for my own eyes. And
trust but verify.
Yeah, well, very good. Yes, George W. Bush, George Bush Sr., who turned out to be a rather better president than I originally expected. In terms of what you were saying, you said that Biden repeatedly, and I think amusingly you put it very well, they set insane glass ceilings and then break them anyway. And can you give us some specifics about the kind of things you mentioned in general terms, for example, the pariahing to an extent Christian faith and Christian beliefs and so on. Are there specifics that particularly bother you?
Well, sure. Actually, in my book, one of the things that I point to as kind of a microcosm that encompasses all of the failures and shortcomings of this administration, which are nothing short of evil, would be the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan. Now, Joe Biden was told repeatedly, you know, you should actually put this off a little longer. We're not prepared. He was warned that perhaps, you know, the Taliban could take back over and would. And he doubled down and said, no, we're going to stick to this date in August, whatever it was. We've got to pull out and so on and so forth. Anyway, of course, despite telling us there's no threat of the Taliban taking over, you know, days later, the Taliban does take over. In that botched withdrawal, of course, we had 13 U.S. service members that were killed in a suicide bombing at the, I think, the Harmai Karzai, however you pronounce it, airport there in Kabul. And here's where it gets wild. And here's what people tend to forget. So after those 13 U.S. service members were killed, you had the Biden administration obviously promise to get revenge, to hold accountable those who were responsible for this. And so they told us that they killed a high-level ISIS-K planner. And then they said it was actually two high-level ISIS-K planners. And the media was actually curious, believe it or not, about this because they said, you know, you're confusing. You said you got one. You said you got two. How many is it? Well, the Biden administration doubled down on saying they killed two high-level ISIS-K planners. All right, we got revenge. Well, it turned out that they didn't kill any ISIS-K planners. They killed 10 innocent Afghans, including 7 children, in a drone strike. And one of the individuals was actually an aid worker that worked for some organization in California. But my point is, they tried to cover it up and they got caught. Shockingly, the New York Times reported on it. And we never got an apology, no heads rolled. But just think about everything that encompasses this administration, from obviously historic failures. They left, of course, billions in American weaponry behind. They killed innocent Afghans in retaliation and lied to us, telling us they killed 2 ISIS-K planners. So this is an administration that is full of liars. It's totally unaccountable. It gets Americans killed and it makes the world a less safe place. So, you know, that's one of those things I point to, which, I mean, I still think about it. Like, where is the reaction from people? This administration, imagine if Trump had done any of those things, you know? And then you have Biden, whose daughter, you know, they like to talk about Donald Trump's character, his character, right? Grab him by the you-know-what comment. He's a terrible person. Well, Joe Biden, we have a diary from Ashley Biden, his daughter, in which she writes that she recalls her father showering inappropriately with her as a young girl. What does this mean? It is her diary. We know it's her diary because Amy Harris, who apparently it's a crime now to take property, a diary from a hotel room or wherever it came from, which is, it's amazing, but she's going to jail for 3 months because she stole the property of Ashley Biden. And that's in the diary. Imagine if Trump's daughter had written he showered inappropriately. So it's just, this is what people have to understand. Most of what they've been told about Trump by the media, certainly in the Democrats, isn't even true. And that which might be a little bit true pales in comparison to the absolutely loathsome corruption and amorality of Joe Biden, or frankly, any Democrat at this point.
Let's then finish with the Donald Trump situation. You clearly think, and you expressly state in unambiguous terms in your book, that Trump is the great hope for America. What do you expect a Trump administration could do if he does get reelected? How will he change course?
Yeah, well, I got to be honest. It's absolutely necessary to get him in there, both to reject the totalitarianism and the election interference and everything else. But I'm concerned about what he'll be able to do, because I remember very vividly 2016, and he did do many good things, despite the overwhelming persecution that even happened in his own administration, even by Republicans. So, I mean, I expect him to go in there and hold Republican elected members, their feet to the fire. I expect him to go in and demand that they fulfill the agenda that is demanded by the American people. I expect him to go in there and clean house as much as he can, I want to send a bull into the China shop, and I want him to break the FBI. I want him to break down the teachers' unions and the education system. I want him to go in there and start the process, most importantly, of changing American minds and continuing to focus on what we really fight ahead. Even after Trump's gone, it's not going to end. He's not going to solve everything. Is that we, the American people, have to take back our country. We have to reassert that we're the master and those in government are servant. And we have to reassert that our rights are unalienable. They don't come from government. And these monsters in government that get away with criminal activity have to be held accountable. Otherwise, this will never stop.
And we only got a very short time left, less than a minute, in fact. If you were to make a prediction about how this election will play out, first of all, will it be Biden versus Trump? And secondly, your prediction about the outcome?
It'll be Biden versus Trump. You know, they're going to use illegals, certainly, to try and replicate in some way what they did in 2020. I think that Trump will prevail. And then we'll have to see what happens. The Democrats are not going to accept the election results if Trump wins. We know that's true. And honestly, I don't think that other Americans will accept the results if Trump loses, based on what they've done. So, you know, the worst has yet to come, and Americans have to be prepared to really, really dig deep and do what's right, stand firm in the face of what is to come, and be the giants that are going to hold up this temple of liberty like our ancestors have.
And who knows, the makings of a civil war?
It's not impossible. Not impossible. But people like me will do everything we can to prevent something like that.
Real pleasure to speak with you. We were just warming up there, Drew Allen. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope you've found it useful. Hope in some ways it might even be helpful counseling. But more than anything, I hope that our viewers found you interesting. Good luck on what you're doing, and I'll be sure to read your book. That's Drew Thomas Allen, who starts finishes our first half of the show, and leads us beautifully into the second half with Donna Jackson, who is very senior in Project 21 Black Leadership Network and has had forays into accounting in a big way, but also into politics and ministry. So we'll continue the debate with Donna in a minute. I'm Len Turpik, standing in for Mark Morano here on Unleashed on today's News Talk TNT. I'll see you after the break.